one is left with the unmistakable sense that Philip is recalling two different times that he saw the humanoid, and so his final remark takes on special meaning. "I was just trying to tell you whatever just sort of popped in my mind. There was not any kind of sequential thing." His description of the events of that long ago night in Pittsburgh was, in his words, very much a collage of impressions. Images were recovered, but not in any precise order. When one puts together the narrative sequence, it closely resembles Howard Rich's experience. First, Philip awakes in his room, absolutely paralyzed, and sensing a presence, a vague silhouette behind him. A strange light fills the room. He gets up, dresses, and goes outside, up the hill to the grounds of the deserted Hines mansion. There, he finds himself drawn toward a group of figures standing behind the building, and the abduction is consummated. His abductors have large, bulging craniums, and metallic, looking eyes. More was to be revealed in his fourth hypnotic session, and much of what we already knew was to be confirmed, for a number of reasons. There was a delay of almost a year between his third and fourth hypnotic sessions. The ebbing and flowing of Philip's hypnotic recall was a frustrating problem that bothered him more than it did Ted and me. We were also busy with our own work, and with a number of other UFO cases, but when the investigation did resume, we were very pleased by the results. As I pointed out in the Stephen Kilburn case, long pauses between hypnotic regressions have one distinct advantage, and that is the sense one has of consistently recalled events. Fantasies can wander promiscuously from month to month, and deliberate inventions are hard to keep straight. If, 10 months later, a hypnotically recalled narrative confirms in both outline and specific detail what was recalled 10 months previously, then we are probably dealing with an actual, historical event. On April 12, 1980, Philip, dead, and I gathered in Dr. Claymore's office to resume our inquiry. Again, the transcript which follows has been edited somewhat to eliminate much of what one could designate the Philip Osborne system of backing and filling, claiming and disclaiming. AC, your memory goes back to that night in Colwanage, that night we have been talking about. Hypnosis is induced. Poe, after you long pause, my dominant impression is of some sort of a presence at the window. That's what all of my attention is focused towards, and it's as if there's a black, blot or something that's obscuring whatever may be there from my vision. The thing that is strange is that my impression of the room is it's very bright, and, there is light, although I know that is not the case. It was not a bright room, and, don't recall any brightness at all, but that's the image that my mind is creating now. Pause. I do feel like there is something that to be seen, not necessarily in this room, but, you know, something that I'm linking to it. AC, if you were to see in that window, what do you imagine would be there? Poe, well, it isn't just now that it's in front of the window, but it's sort of in the middle of my field of vision, and that's what I am trying to, lift. But it does not happen. As to what I would imagine to be there, the only thing that I notice is that I sense a kind of presence there. Long pause. I can imagine myself in another environment, almost, as if I am in another place or another enclosure, and it isn't so much being able to see it, as just sensing it. Long pause. And I do have a sort of a sense of reclining and of being kind of enveloped in a sort of hazy kind of state. For some reason, it seems as if I'm sort of aware of two small balls or spheres that are illuminated from within. They're sort of either on either side of my head, or I'm not sure that they stay there in that position, but there is a feeling almost as if I am encased in a kind of dome, but it has that impression. Long pause. There's confusion concerning those things that I am describing as balls. I can almost have the impression that they are eyes, but there definitely is a state of calmness associated with this image. It is as if one suddenly makes that transition, and I do recall that, A.C. Poe, from earlier sessions here, that there is a definite transition where all of a sudden calmness seems to prevail. Pause. I almost have the sensation that I could be floating in a reclining position, or at least not aware of whatever may be supporting me, but there is just a kind of energy field surrounding me, or a kind of hazy kind of quality. I could imagine that there is some presence there. It's almost as if, you know, I can sense that someone is around, but I do not see anybody. Long pause. I have the sense of something uncanny, and, you know, like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. But then I did go back to that, sense of paralysis. The strange thing is that my attention is drawn to a telephone at the head of the bed, and I do recall that that time I had the sensation that I should reach for the telephone and call for help. But there wasn't any telephone there. I don't know why I would think of a telephone. There was no telephone there. That was one thing that was very illogical. Could you describe this Wizard of Oz figure? It was the Wizard of Oz character. It wasn't, I'm sure it wasn't anything that I saw. It was just an association. I'm trying to imagine leaving the house and, for some reason, I see myself leaving by the front door, which I don't think I would have normally done. I'm just trying to imagine what possible way I did go when I left the house. For some reason, I do just feel drawn to that spot, the Hines house. I see kind of an aerial map and all of the lines are pointing in that direction. It's as if I'm sort of tracing through it without so much experiencing it, but I can imagine myself going up a driveway which is relatively close to the house and, there's almost an arrow that points over to the, to my left, which would be on the opposite end of the house, and, almost a kind of a sense of inquisitiveness on my part, not a fear or anything. And I think that, at another time, I have said that I sensed a sort of activity there. Now, it isn't so much as if there is an activity, but it's almost as if there are people standing there, almost in a line. I don't see them precisely as people, but you just have the impression of figures. And, there's nothing more to see there. It's all very dark. It's more of an impression. Long pause. I hesitate to say it. But, I have, almost a sense of a flying saucer there and I'm just trying to imagine what might have happened next. I long pause. I don't see any light around at all. Of course, it may have been, I mean, whatever might have been there, there may have been a starlit sky, a moonlit sky, with the lights from the surrounding houses reflected in the sky, but there isn't any light there. And I do recall before that there was a sense of activity or something. Someone moving around and doing something in the darkness. But I don't know exactly how that connects with the impression now. After another long pause, Dr. Claymore brought Philip out of the trance. Ted and I began to question him both about the new details he had recalled and his calmer behavior in the hypnotic state. I commented upon the fact that he had not seemed so nervous this time. And he agreed. Saying that he had definitely felt more detached. B.H., now, you said, the two spheres that seemed to be illuminated appeared to be small. You said they were on either side of you. Close to the face. Poe, yes. And then I sort of have the feeling that, well, you know, you have these kind of dreamlike impressions that are very difficult to describe, of course, that they could have moved above me. As I say, I could almost sense that they were eyes at some point, but initially, I mean, in dreams sometimes one thing can sometimes transpose itself into something else, and these are just the kinds of impressions that I have. B.H., the big eye. You see, we've talked about before. The big eye, you saw the single eye. Close to you. Poe, yes. Well, I wasn't aware. One frankly don't remember what I said about that, but I wasn't aware of a single eye close to me. B.H., yes. That was more an earlier experience anyway. Poe, yes. B.H., associating that with the Tennessee experience. T.B., Philip. On the association of place with these two spheres, do you get the sense of being in your room at Carnegie Tech? Poe, no, no, no. This was where I had sort of been displaced to. Gone beyond that into another, BH, another area. Enclosure. I think you used the word enclosure.
Poe, yes.
I had the sense that, you know, there was a kind of space all around me and that I was more or less in the mid-middle dot die of it. B.H., one other thing that you mentioned now that I don't recall your having mentioned before, this is an incorrect memory, B.H.L. was a brightness in your room. You didn't think this was ordinary to the room.
Poe, no.
And I don't recall it, either. That's one I certainly, you know, I don't recall it from anything. I don't know why that suddenly presented itself. But I had somewhat the feeling that maybe that was something one was inventing to counteract the unpleasantness of that occasion. You know, suddenly L was feeling the room as bright and a more cheerful kind of place.
B.H., you said this thing about feeling very relaxed and calm, and that there was a transition where you passed something that had not been very calm, and went into a calm state. You did mention that actually at an earlier session, too.
Poe,
yes, and I recall that.
You know, there are certain things when you are coming to, that you suddenly do remember, something that you had experienced previously. We adjourned shortly thereafter to a delicatessen for more conversation and a bit of lunch. In response to a question, Phi-1-Nip elaborated on one of the details he had obliquely, and rather unclearly, mentioned when he was in the trance state, and this was the matter of the hazy kind of state. He said that around the table on which he lay, or floated, the atmosphere itself seemed hazy, or glary, as if the air was not absolutely transparent. Immediately, I remembered Stephen's words, I almost want to say that the air in the room is white also. Everything is kind of milky or misty or something. It doesn't shine. But everything has almost that metallic kind of glow to it. Including me.
Virginia Horton, the reader will recall, described the color of the light as being pale gray, or a real soft gray, pearly, those kinds of colors. When I see the adjective pearly, I picture not so much a specific hue as a particular kind of delicate reflectiveness in which the light in front of an object appears to be intangibly colored. I do not want to force my definition upon the reader, but my guess is that Virginia is using a different metaphor for the same conditions that Stephen and Philip are describing in the preceding chapter. I gave other examples from the case literature of this kind of observation. A recently published book, The Tujunga Canyon Contacts, 5, includes an interesting double confirmation. A young female abductee who is called Laurie in the book describes the light inside the UFO as being misty. But she also describes small, round lights like Philip's glowing spheres which moved over her body. I felt like being on an operating table and being inspected. Those lights going over me were like scanner lights. I was being inspected in a relatively painless manner by some sort of light. It wasn't threatening to me. Philip had been quick to explain that the large eye he had earlier described was not connected with the Pittsburgh encounter. This time, the scanning, if that is what the function is, was carried out by the small moving spheres of light. The mechanical man for which he invoked the calming and charming image of the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz is a full, scale version of what in earlier sessions had been merely an armored hand. He described the benign, and, sadly, heartless, film character not as anything that I saw. It was just an association. Jack Haley standing in, as it were, for something that in actuality was probably far more unsettling. Again, the unconscious mind seems to be avoiding, or at least softening, the clear, fearful edges of remembered reality. Putting together all of Philip's basic images and superimposing them upon the narrative as it presented itself, this is what we can safely surmise. In 1950, at the age of 7, or possibly the following summer, Philip and his family traveled back up the Tennessee mountaintop after dark to retrieve his brother's lost jacket. In some as yet unknown fashion, Philip was apparently separated from his family and pulled swiftly into a UFO resembling a geodesic dome, which hovered in a deserted parking lot. His physical capture and abduction without abductors is similar in its degree of vagueness to Virginia Horton's, inside the UFO. As Philip lay on a table in a hospital-like environment, A robot arm made an incision, removed something from his leg, and then closed the wound. Above him hung a large eye-like apparatus which at first frightened him, but then calmed him. The method of his return to his family in their automobile is as yet unclear. About 13 or 14 years later, it was probably 1964, Philip awoke in his third floor room near Pittsburgh's Carnegie Tech to find himself totally paralyzed. He sensed a presence, a silhouette, at the window behind his head. Light suffused the room. In moments, the paralysis left him. He dressed and went outside. Following mental directions, like a roadmap in his mind, he ascended the hill behind his house to the grounds of the deserted Hines mansion. Feeling inquisitive and without fear, he approached a line of figures standing behind the house. Nearby, there was a flying saucer and, in some way, he next found himself reclining inside a domed room filled with hazy light. Two small glowing balls or spheres hovered on either side of his head, which again calmed him. Two types of figures are associated with this experience: a pinkish, flesh-colored humanoid with metallic eyes and translucent skin, and a metallic, very shiny, robot-like figure with jointed, armored hands. Exactly what else happened, how Philip returned to his room, is still unclear. A particularly striking indication of the accuracy and tenacity of Philip's hypnotic recall came to light through an innocent error of Ted Bloch's. Immediately after the fourth hypnotic session in April of 1980, Ted mentioned that the line of figures Philip reported in front of the Hines mansion was seen this time in general darkness. 10 months earlier, Ted thought, Philip had described them moving in front of a bright light. Philip immediately disagreed. I don't think I said that. I guess I may have because I never remember everything I have said before, but I really don't think I ever saw them against any bright light. We checked a transcript of the June 1979 session and Philip was right, he had never reported seeing the figures against light. It was a simple misrecollection of Ted's, but it offered a test both of Philip's suggestibility and the tenacity of his remembered imagery. We were all pleased that the error had occurred. The spectrum of human response to the abduction experience is indeed a wide one, yet the varieties of human behavior and recall under hypnotic regression are vastly larger. The transcripts I have presented vividly illustrate these problems. But it is my belief that what we have here is not a wide, irregular collection of various UFO abduction accounts, each equipped with its own degree of credibility. Instead, we are seeing a wide variety of human response to the same basic, unearthly experience. And later, to the still different and unsettling act of recalling this experience through hypnosis. The abductees vary more than the abduction process itself. Philip Osborne's and Virginia Horton's accounts show this perhaps more clearly than any other pair of cases I have studied. In neither instance, we must remember, was there any prior conscious memory of a UFO sighting or anything else that would indicate a possible abduction? By the middle of May 1979, we had uncovered many of the aforementioned details of Philip's second, his Pittsburgh, abduction, but by a fortuitous coincidence, I was able, a few months later, to visit the site where we believed it had happened. In September of 1979, I received an invitation to lecture at the Carnegie Institute's Museum of Art on the occasion of Willem de Kooning's retrospective exhibition. In a nicely unorthodox decision, the museum staff had decided to ask a painter who had known and admired de Kooning and his work for many years, rather than an art historian, a colleague rather than a critic. Philip gave me the location of the house he had lived in, and when I arrived in Pittsburgh on December 10th, a sculpture acquaintance of mine drove me to the spot. After my lecture later that night, I revisited the area to try to judge its plausibility as a UFO landing site. The Hines Mansion is the largest of several houses and outbuildings spread over perhaps 15 acres. It is occupied today by a religious order, and by 11:30 in the evening, everything was quite dark. Knowing what I knew from Philip's account, the place took on an eerie, slumbering quality as I walked across the silent lawn. a few lights from some neighboring houses and the distant sounds of traffic coming from down below barely touched the dark, isolated calm. The hilltop was flat except for a large, roughly 10-foot deep, bowl-like depression, the remains, I guessed, of a pond which must have been drained many years before. Everything about the place reinforced its plausibility as the location of a UFO landing site. Everything about its desolate mood underlined the idea that Philip, after the fright he'd experienced in his room, would only have walked up this hill if he had had absolutely no choice in the matter. Chapter 8, The Alsatian Deer. At the time of Virginia Horton's first hypnotic session, Aphrodite Claymore made a telling observation. She pointed out that, when a young child receives a deep gash which bleeds copiously, the event invariably becomes part of the family oral history. The day Susie slipped on the rock and cut her leg open and it bled so badly. For example, I have a small scar on my scalp where I was hit by a sharp tin can. The accident happened around 1937. My older brother and his friends were playing kick, there, can. And Jimmy Gilliland's foot sent the can hard against me. 43 years later, the details are still vivid to my mother and my brother. Evidently I bled dramatically. And another childhood accident entered the family chronicles. It is against everything we would normally expect that, though Virginia's parents remember their daughter's deep childhood wound, they have no idea at all of its origin. And in 1979, when Philip Osborne first asked his mother about the source of his scar, she could not remember anything about it, either. A few weeks later, she told him that she thought she remembered something about his falling off a tricycle and cutting himself, but she wasn't sure. I called her in May of 1979, and this time she said she thought he had cut himself on the sharp edge of a toy. I asked if she remembered actually witnessing the accident or if she recalled what kind of a toy it had been, and she answered no to both questions, though her recollections were admittedly, and strangely, vague. She was certain of one thing: the accident had happened in the evening when there was no way to get Philip to a doctor. His wound, she said, was treated at home. Under hypnosis, Philip described the environment where the incision was made as being a hospital, like with a stretcher-like table. His mother's statement that he definitely had not been taken to a doctor's office or to a hospital's emergency room is therefore significant. It eliminates the possibility that Philip could be confusing his incision's white environment with a real hospital since he had not been taken to one in the first place. Nothing is more vivid than blood. A childhood accident which causes a wound deep enough to leave a noticeable scar 30 years later should have become a dramatic event in family history. The details of this kind of traumatic episode should have become deeply etched in parental memory, yet neither Philip's nor Virginia's mother seems to recall very much at all about what happened to her child. Beyond recollecting that the accidents happened when their children were very young, everything is hazy. If the causes of their wounds were as Virginia and Philip recall them through hypnosis, incisions made by remote control, robot-like machinery inside a UFO, then everything falls into place. The parents remember very little for two and possibly three reasons. First, none of the parents actually witnessed their child's accident, so they could have no idea, first hand, of its cause. Second, neither child had any conscious memory of how the injuries occurred, either, and so neither was able to explain anything at all to the parents. There were no details to remember, except the fact of the wound itself. And third, there is very possibly a degree of control by the UFO occupants of the parents' memories as well as those of the children, as we have seen in the David Oldham case, for example, and as I have noticed in numerous other cases. The particular person or persons who were abducted are not the only people involved whose recollections have been tampered with. One should expect, with such distinct scars as those Virginia and Philip bear, the only mark on my body, Virginia said, that the parents definitely should remember more about these accidents than they do, unless, of course, more than a mere dollop of forgetfulness was stirred in from the outside. When Virginia first called her mother in 1979 to ask about the original 1950 farmyard incident, her mother was slow to remember, but she was quick to recall the time Virginia emerged from the French woods and discovered blood on her blouse. Virginia, herself, had almost forgotten this second episode, but a moment's reflection offers a possible reason for their varying degrees of recollection. The difference is caused by the movie Virginia's father took of the picnic. Virginia's mother had seen the film a number of times, so the image of her daughter's blood-bespattered blouse would have burned into her memory. Virginia told me that she, herself, hated the movie because of the stains, again, the unnerving vividness of blood. The physical reality of the film image was something she actively tried to put out of her mind. It was unpleasantly graphic, and it had, after all, happened to her. For her mother, however, the film record of the 1960 incident may have successfully counteracted the memory control exerted that time by Virginia's abductors. Obviously, this is speculation, but it does present a plausible explanation of what seem to be arbitrary differences in the two women's degree of recall. Virginia and I met 10 weeks after her first session for her second hypnotic session. Our main goal was to explore her 1960 experience in France, but there were also a number of loose ends left dangling from the 1957 abduction recall. Central was the issue of how she got inside the UFO in the first place. We talked about this problem before hypnosis began, and Virginia said she had a vague sense of having been physically picked up and carried by someone, though the details were unclear. It was just as though somebody was carrying me over to the couch and setting me down. I don't think I was picked up by a machine, or by a vacuum, nothing like that. It was like a humanoid-type person picking me up and carrying me. I haven't had any vivid memories about it. I brought the conversation around to the subject at hand. B.H., that incident in France at the picnic. Have you thought much about it? Well, I just thought about it, but nothing came back to me, except to remember again the sense of wonder that I had at the time at the beautiful, beautiful deer that I saw. You know, it was as though I had walked out of the woods and claimed that I saw a unicorn. There was that sense of excitement and wonder. And when I think about the visual memories that I had, there wasn't anything unusual about the deer, except that it was looking at me, and it was looking at me in a very conscious kind of way. But it could just as easily have been that I was hypnotized and thought I saw a deer to make it easy to have a story to tell. A.C. Yes, it could have been suggested. B.H., you mentioned that to me, in fact, the very first time we talked about it. V.H., yes. Right. B.H., as a matter of fact, you said something to the effect that the more you talked about the deer to your parents, the less you were sure you had even seen a deer. You said it was like you were high on the idea of having seen the deer and yet you weren't sure how real it was. V.H., no, it was a very real experience, but I was just speculating to you that maybe it wasn't a real deer. Maybe it was something else I was suggested to remember as a deer. I don't have any doubts that I saw something that moved me. Something real. It wasn't a product of my imagination. It may have had a hypnotic cover, but it looked like a deer to my memory. Dr. Clammer begins the induction of hypnosis and chokes Virginia back to the age of 6 in her grandfather's farmyard. V.H., I'm just looking around the yard, remembering the way it was. I was a lot more connected to the grounds then than I am now. I used to notice, you know, how the dirt was different on rainy days than on dry days, and how the plants changed every day. The dandelions turned fluffy, you know, when they make their seeds. This was something that I was connected to every day, which I'm not anymore, to the animals and to the yard. A.C., would you like to re-experience that connectedness? V.H., yes. I would. A.C., at the count of 3. You will find yourself reliving and re-experiencing and revivifying the connectedness that you felt. The earth, your environment, and yourself. 1, 2, 3. Long pause, rocks, 2. Every day I would go out to play and I would talk to the plants and the animals in the yard and the chickens and all these things. I think that's one of the things I told my friend on the ship. I told him about the different kinds of animals. I guess that's how we got to talking about chickens. I think from that, that's when he suggested that I go gather the eggs and bring them in. I don't think my mother had told me to gather the eggs.